from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, as the partial federal government shutdown enters its second week, we'll check in on negotiations in Congress. We'll discuss the potential short and long-term effects of the shutdown, and we'll get an update for you on the debt ceiling crisis. There appears to be some movement on that front, with the White House signaling today that President Obama might accept a short-term increase in the federal borrowing cap. We'll take all that up, and we want to hear from you. Are you being affected by the government shutdown, and how concerned are you about government default? That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We want to update you in this hour on the federal partial shutdown and its effects in the short as well as the long term, but many believe the focus is already beginning to shift to the debt limit and the possibility of a default, which, by the way, the Treasury Department has said could trigger a worse financial crisis than we saw back in 2008. How dysfunctional is Congress, and what will it take to get the government working again? Joining us this hour for conversation is Julie Hirschfield Davis. She is national political reporter with Bloomberg News and joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Thomas Mann with us, who is a senior fellow in governance studies with the Brookings Institution, co-author with Norman Ornstein of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the Politics of Extremism. And that book has just been released in paperback with a new preface and an afterword. Thomas Mann, welcome to the program.
Happy to be with you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Bill Whalen with us this morning, research fellow with the Hoover Institution and a contributor at Hoover's Advancing a Free Society blog and a regular columnist now with the Sacramento Bee. Bill Whalen, welcome to Forum.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Let me begin, Julie Hirschfield Davis, with you. We heard earlier from Cokie Roberts this morning on Morning Edition that there may be no back doors, at least according to Speaker Boehner. But over the weekend, he was saying that the default is the path we're on. And yet, also earlier this morning, word is out that the president may be seeking a short-term negotiation. I'm just looking, actually, at the wording of this. It's a senior White House official, Gene Sperling, who directs the National Economic Council, who says, yes, we may talk about a short-term negotiation. Does this change the game?
Well, not in the short term. It doesn't. I mean, what the White House is saying is we still want a clean debt ceiling increase. We're not going to have any conditions on raising the borrowing limit for this country. But what they are saying is, Sperling said, listen, a short-term debt limit extension is better than default. If that's what it's going to take to get us to the point where we can see our way clear to raise the debt ceiling and have a negotiation about a broader deal, then we're willing to pursue that. This is sort of a recognition on the part of the White House that politically, this we won't negotiate, slam the door in your face kind of approach is actually undermining what leverage they have in the current standoff. We heard Boehner this weekend on the Sunday talk show saying, you know, there just aren't the votes for a clean debt ceiling increase. And I think this is what we're starting to see is the White House and Democrats on Capitol Hill starting to try to figure out ways of calling his bluff on that. You hear Sperling leaving the door open to a shorter term increase if that could get them toward a negotiation, toward a broader deal. And also now we're hearing that Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate on Capitol Hill, is going to actually put together a clean debt ceiling bill to try to move it through the Senate in order to put pressure on Republicans there, particularly the more moderate Republicans, to put them on record. Okay, are you going to do this or are you not? Are you going to move us toward a default or are you going to join us and say, the full faith and credit of the U.S. is too important to play around with this.
Well, since you're speaking about moderate Republicans in the Senate, there was a lot of savaging by many of those Republicans of Ted Cruz. And we've got a number of Republicans now, seven, I believe, from New Jersey and Pennsylvania, who are in districts where they're being hurt by this. And they've essentially gone on record as saying, look, we don't want Obamacare, but this is too big a problem, shutting down the government. Is there possibly some kind of shift in all of that?
Well, I mean, I think what we've seen now for a while, and it's definitely picked up pace in the last few days since the government actually shut down, is, you know, you do have now almost about two dozen House Republicans saying, you know, we get the fight on health care. We don't like the health care bill any more than the rest of our Republican colleagues do. But we need to pass a clean CR that is a continuing resolution to keep the government, to reopen the government without conditions. And let's leave that fight for another day. What we're also hearing, actually, interestingly, is some Tea Party Republicans, more conservative members who were elected with the support of the Tea Party, saying, okay, this is not working with Obamacare. We've tried to get rid of it. It's clearly not working. Let's shift our sights to something else. Let's shift our sights to a broader deal on tax reform, to maybe entitlement cuts. All of this maybe as part of a broader debt ceiling deal. And I think that's the context for the change in rhetoric you're hearing from the White House, where they're saying, oh, okay, well, you know, if you guys want to talk, let's at least make sure that we head off a default and maybe there's something to talk about.
Well, Thomas Mann, we're still hearing Ted Cruz say that the debt ceiling is leverage against Obamacare, even though 42 times, I guess, by last count, there was an attempt to overturn Obamacare in the legislature. And the GOP is also demanding for a raising of the debt ceiling, but they have to presumably save some face here, especially with the more conservative or hardliner wing. And one has to wonder if, well, and Medicare, Social Security, deficits, all the things they've been talking about, even the pipeline, are kind of up for the negotiations here.
Well, I don't believe they are. Face-saving devices are, you know, important, and the administration ought to see if something might be possible. But Republicans have moved in a really unprecedented way with both the shutdown and, most importantly, the debt ceiling that threatened to wreak havoc on our entire democratic system. We really can't live by this kind of blackmail. You know, if you won't reach an agreement, we'll blow up the economy. That is, if you don't do what we want. That's not the way our system works. And frankly, the debt ceiling has always been a focus of partisan games. But in the past, everyone knew, including the leaders of both parties and the president, that the votes would be there. There was no one threatening default. Now it's of a really different order. So I mean, Sperling's comments are a little odd. I think the administration is still holding to the notion of a clean debt ceiling, but it might take a shorter-term one with the promise of taking the debt ceiling off the table forever. That is a permanent solution to remove this because Congress can't be trusted with it, frankly, or at least one party in opposition now can't be. And it's just too risky to the country's well-being and, frankly, to the global economy.
Talking with Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that seems to reflect the business community's growing opposition. But on the other hand, there was an article that appeared in the Sunday New York Times that said, this had kind of been a planned strategy all along, that Ed Meese, former Attorney General Ed Meese, and one of the Koch brothers, and perhaps Sheldon Adelson, that they decided they wanted to do this and they wanted to tough it out regardless.
Yeah, that was a fascinating piece in the Times. It was clearly directed toward Obamacare and figuring this is the last moment at which it could be killed, that once it opens and people start availing themselves of the benefits of the law, it would be much more difficult. So they've built enormous pressure on the Republican leadership, particularly in the House, to in effect threaten both the shutdown of partial shutdown of government and a public default. It was always a bizarre strategy. It really had no chance of being agreed to. But they're living in a different world. It's kind of like election night, 2012. Romney and tons of Republican strategists, including Karl Rove, were convinced that Romney would win the election, no matter what the overwhelming evidence suggested. And frankly, that's now continuing on to much more serious matters, particularly the debt ceiling. I have a feeling we're going to go down to the brink on this. John Boehner has said there isn't a majority in the House to pass a clean debt ceiling. A lot of members disagree with him on that. I think virtually all Democrats would vote for it, and they're, as Julie said, now somewhere approaching 25 Republicans who've indicated their support for that. If Boehner got behind it, those numbers on the Republican side would increase. So there is a way out, and it's awfully late to begin negotiations on fiscal policy. Remember, that wasn't even part of the shutdown threat. That was all about Obamacare. Now they're reviving a grand bargain, which they have studiously avoided over the entire year. The procedures were there to engage the Senate through the competing budget resolutions to work out a deal, but there was no real interest on the Republican side. The deficit issue had begun to settle down. It's half of what it was 2 years ago. It's stabilizing in the short term, although we still have big long-term problems that need to be dealt with. But if you insist on no new taxes, those negotiations aren't going anywhere. And certainly a threat of default is not going to persuade the Democrats or the president to accept that deal.
Again, Thomas Mann is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies with the Brookings Institution and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks with Norman Ornstein. Bill Whalen is a research fellow at Hoover. He's a contributor at Hoover's Advancing a Free Society blog and a regular columnist for the Sacramento Bee. And I don't know, Bill, if you saw an article by John Diaz this weekend where he said Republicans are getting a lot of the blame for this because of brinksmanship and playing to the independents and playing to their base by Tea Party Republicans. And it suggests maybe a drift to a kind of one-party rule, which is what happened in California. But I can't also help thinking that a lot of this is just an opening act for the presidential politics of 2016. Ted Cruz and others really trying to get the limelight.
Yeah, you're right. And I did see that article. I was actually quoted in the article, so I'm familiar with it. Yes, it's, you raise a good point, Michael. You're seeing, in some respects, the curtain opening on the 2016 election, at least as far as Republicans are concerned. I could give you at least 10 Republicans who are interested in 2016, and they break down into different categories, and some fall in the category of Ted Cruz, who essentially want to go to Washington and burn down the village. There are others like Paul Ryan, who's been very quiet throughout this, but I think will emerge this week, who are very interested in long-term fixing of the budget process. So you see these Republican divisions playing out, but I think as we look at the current situation in Washington, this is sort of a problem which is coming to a head, and it's a problem of several makings. First of all, we don't have a divided government. We have a fragmented government. A divided government would be one party on one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, another party on the other end. Instead, you have one party on one end of the White House and the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Congress, split in half. That's fragmentation. The second problem I'd say we have here is that the 2012 election was, I'm going to disagree with Tom a little bit, it was a split verdict. Barack Obama was the winner, yes, but Mitt Romney won 226 congressional districts at the same time. So this gives Republicans a little ammunition saying that the president may have won, but there's an audience out there for us as well. And then the third point is we go into Obamacare itself and just the very complicated path that this bill has taken. It was a party-line vote. Republicans did not vote for it. There was a controversial Supreme Court decision. There was the president cherry-picking with it earlier this year where he took out the employer mandate side of it, which just infuriated Republicans. This is something the Republicans just have to get out of their system. And I think that's one of the interesting questions moving forward here. They have voted against this thing 42 times. Is 43 going to be the charm? They're going to let it go. Will this be one of the deals that they work out with the White House where the president says that we'll work with you on the debt ceiling and the budget if you agree to let go of Obamacare?
Well, you talk about fragmentation, though. I mean, you got 30 Republicans dictating to 200 Republicans.
Well, you do, but you have to keep in mind the Republican caucus is divided in at least three ways. all are fiscal conservatives. All will claim they're fiscal conservatives, but there's a group in there who would call themselves moderates. Moderates maybe not in the sense of being a Democrat, but moderate in the sense that they want to work on things like immigration reform. They don't like the party's obsession with social conservative issues. There are those fiscal conservatives who just want to focus on that fiscal conservatism. And then you have the third group, which is the Ted Cruz group, and they're the ones I mentioned. They're the ones who burned down the village. So poor John Boehner at all times has to keep these three factions happy.
How do you see this in light of 1996 with Gingrich and Clinton? I mean, there's much more asperity now, isn't there? Much more animosity and
yeah. Yeah, I think a couple things worth pointing out. First of all, the simplest solution to this whole mess is to what? Have five people get in one room in the White House, and that's the president, the four leaders of Congress. For all the divisions between the two parties, I just consider how very little respect there is among those five people. You go back to 1996, and you had Bob Dole leading the Republicans in the Senate, a real experienced government guy, a Washington guy who liked to do deals, and Newt Gingrich for the Republicans. Now, we can have a long talk about Newt Gingrich, but he and Bill Clinton actually had a lot in common besides just being sort of complicated men children from the South. They kind of agreed on the need to downsize the government, so there was a lot of common room, which made that deal-making easy. This time around, the sides just don't like each other. Look at the words that have been swept. I mean, look what Harry Reid has been saying about John Boehner on the record. It's just not pleasant. So, yeah, there's a lot more animosity. The other thing worth pointing out here, by the way, is back in 1996, I believe there were something like 50 Republicans who were sitting in districts that Bill Clinton carried in 1996. This time around, I think there are 9 Democrats in districts that Mitt Romney carried, and I think 17 Republicans in districts that Barack Obama carried. So, you know, it's not just rhetorically partisan split, it's partisan splits in terms of the actual votes.
I'm going to open up the phone lines. I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. And how concerned are you about the government default? And are you being affected by the government partial shutdown? What are your thoughts? And please join the conversation because we invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And we do appreciate and welcome your calls and invite you to call us now again at 866-733-6786. You can also email us forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments you have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or feel free to tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking with Bill Whalen from the Hoover Institution, Thomas Mann from the Brookings Institution, and Julie Hirschfeld Davis, who is national political reporter with Bloomberg News. This just seems, Julie, to be so ideological, well, an ideological impasse. I mean, any light from your perspective in this that would open up a possibility in the short term of opening things?
I mean, you know, we always say in all these crises that it's always darkest before the dawn, but I think we're pretty far from that at this point. We actually had Newt Gingrich on our radio airwaves not too long ago, and he said, listen, I mean, I don't care how much you dislike each other. The entire time the government was shut down in 1995-96, he and Clinton were talking. And you have to kind of get in a space where you're just basically, you know, bargaining with each other behind the scenes. There are ongoing talks, and there's a channel there till you both get so, he used the word exhausted, but basically until you can find a way out of it. And as we know from what Boehner said over the weekend, from what President Obama has said publicly as well, Boehner, I think, said there is a back room, it's just there's nobody in it. Those channels just don't exist right now. And I don't think they're going to exist for a little while longer anyway, at least another week, until we get close enough to what the markets and everyone who deals with the markets really believes is going to be a catastrophic situation globally and in the U.S. Before they actually feel the pressure to really get there and do something. And as Tom said, I mean, it is pretty late in the game to be talking about a grand bargain that they haven't been able to reach in months and months and months and years of trying.
Well, then I'm inferring from what you're saying that there isn't really any conversation or talking going on now. The Republicans have said, in fact, President Obama seems to be willing to talk to Rouhani of Iran, but he doesn't talk to us. the obstacles, the barriers are there just in terms of face-to-face talking in some back room?
That has been a favorite talking point of the Republicans in the last week or so. I mean, yeah, I think part of the problem here is each side sees the political upside of this for themselves. And certainly Democrats, if you talk to Democrats, they will privately say, and actually a White House official got in some trouble last week for saying this to a reporter on background, unnamed person, that they thought they were, quote, winning the shutdown. They think that the longer this goes on, the more Republicans look extreme and out of touch and maybe malicious. They think there's a potential for it to accrue to their advantage in the Virginia governor's race that's coming up next month, the election's coming up next month. They think there's a potential for it. It's really helping them in the polls. There were some polls out late last week suggesting that there could be an effect on their ability to win seats in the House. They think it's going to help them keep the Senate. So that's not a good incentive for them to want to go to the table, just in purely craven political terms. Republicans, on the other hand, you know, Bill mentioned that this is sort of a precursor to 2016. They see a real opportunity here. The health care law is just rolling out now. They're really calling attention to their opposition to it. They think it's going to turn out horribly for Democrats and the president. They want to put themselves as strongly as they can on record and willing to go to the mat for getting rid of or at least scaling back this law. And they also think that to the degree that they have lost some ground in 2012 in the presidential race and their failure to take control of the Senate, this could be an opportunity for them to really crystallize the difference between them and Democrats and potentially get themselves back on winning footing. So, I mean, that does not make for a political recipe for everyone to want to go into a room and say, okay, I'll give you this, you give me that. Both sides think they're winning to some degree right now.
Well, there's another wrinkle to that, Tom Mann, and that is, I happen to read an editorial in Forbes supporting the shutdown, saying it makes a U.S. debt default less likely, but also in addition to the shutdown being, in effect, showing the opposition to Obamacare, which they believe is necessary in the GOP, or at least in the Tea Party part of the GOP. This argument said it's good to counter the majority now and then. Wendy Davis did this in Texas with abortion and using a number of examples along those lines, same-sex marriage and so forth. But what we have here really is very different than that. What we have here, is it not, is a total shutdown of government.
What a bizarre argument. It's hard to know what in the world they were thinking about. I mean, we are living at the edge of a serious crisis. It's all self-inflicted. It's utterly unnecessary. If Republicans are convinced Obamacare is so unpopular and so doomed to failure, step back and use it in the 2014 and 16 elections, and they'll sweep to victory and be in a position to control the White House and both houses of Congress and do what they want to do. That's how it's supposed to work in our system. That is, elections make a difference. You know, Bill said, well, that we had a split verdict on the presidential elections. Wait a minute. It doesn't matter that Romney carried a majority of House districts because they weren't voting for Romney in those House districts. But more importantly, Republicans are distributed over the country differently.
Tom, I'm coming up on a hard break.
I'm sorry.
I'm coming up on a hard break. I want to hear what Bill Whelan has to say to that. Bill?
Well, it does matter. He carried a majority district. Barack Obama carried a majority district the past time. What it gives Tom is Republicans an argument for vox populi, that there's still a sentiment out there for what they're doing. And then you add to that the polls would show that Obamacare, a plurality of Americans, do not support Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. So there is fuel to their fire. I don't agree with their tactics. I think you're right. They should have let it play out in 2014. But they, in their world, see some basis to what they're doing.
All right, and when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Again, we're talking with Tom Mann, Bill Whelan, and Julie Hirschfeld Davis. And we'll hear from you again as the partial federal government shutdown continues. We're talking about, well, what's going on in Congress and what will need to happen in the short and long term to get the government working again, if indeed it can get working again. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As the partial federal government shutdown enters its second week, we're talking about negotiations in Congress, discussing both the potential short as well as the long-term effects of the shutdown, and getting an update on the debt ceiling crisis. And there appears to be at least some movement on that front, with the White House signaling today that President Obama might accept a short-term increase in federal borrowing cap. And we're going to go right to your calls. Let's go first to Arthur. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually working with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. That work has been shut down because of the government shutdown. The last time that we had a grand bargain with Speaker of the House John Boehner, he couldn't uphold his end of the bargain because of the Tea Party scaredness. How do we know he'll do any better this time?
Julie?
Well, the answer is we don't, and he doesn't. And that's why we've seen him be so reluctant to kind of come off of his position. And, you know, he said over the weekend he didn't think that this fight was going to come this early over funding the government or shutting it down. He thought it was going to be on the debt ceiling. But, you know, working with his members, and he's very, very heavy on, you know, I always want to listen to my members and do what my members tell me they want to do and let the House work its will. You know, this is what they decided. This is where they decided they wanted to make their stand. I mean, I think that is a lot of the problem that we're seeing now is, as Tom mentioned, a lot of people just do the math and see that there are votes there to do a clean CR at this point, to reopen the government and kind of get beyond this. Now, that's not to say necessarily that there would be the votes among a large portion of Republicans for a clean debt limit increase, but there's certainly the potential to get us past at least this go round. The question is, what would he do after that? And he would really have to go up against this, you know, very vocal faction of fiscal conservative Republicans in the House in order to get something else done here.
Let me read a few listener comments from our website. Listener writes, forget the Tea Party. House Republicans and John Boehner have thrown out representational voting as the method that governs this country. I don't see blackmail anywhere in the Constitution, but that's their new chosen method of government. John Boehner is undermining both democracy and the Constitution. And Karis tweets to us, stop calling and letting your guest diminish its weight by referring to the Affordable Care Act as a bill. It's a law. Another listener, Roy, writes on our website, if candidates seek office calling themselves Tea Party candidates first and Republicans second, then they should stand alone as a political party. Various state-level secretaries of state around the nation need to look into this. Truth in labeling has a place in elections, too. And I wonder, Tom Mann, what your response is to this listener email from Regina, who says, it seems clear to me that President Obama is blackmailing the country by not negotiating on the health care bill in order to get the debt funded. The health care bill was passed without knowing what was in it, according to Nancy Pelosi. Now we know what's in it and what it's about, and a good majority of taxpayers don't want it.
Oh, that's almost Orwellian. It's the law of the land. It was deliberated in the Senate for 7 months in negotiations with a handful of Republicans who at the end said they were doing this, but they weren't ever considering voting for it, even though its roots are in the Republican Party. It's very close to what the Republican alternative to the Clinton's health reform was, and it's embodied in Mitt Romney's Massachusetts care. So I think that didn't exist at all. Most Americans still don't know what's in the bill. 4 out of 5 Americans will not be affected directly by it. If you parse the contents of the bill, you will find Americans are for almost all parts of it. And by strong majorities, Americans neither want to repeal nor defund it. They're all for sort of improving it over time, but they don't want a government shutdown or a public default used as extortion to force changes in law. That is akin to John C. Calhoun's nullification in the pre-Civil War period. That's not how our government works.
And we go to another caller. Tamara, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really concerned about the debt ceiling situation. David Stockman, who used to run Office of Management Budget for Reagan, and other sane adults are saying that debt ceiling stasis, if we don't raise the debt ceiling, will not produce default, that there's enough revenue on a regular basis to service the debt, to make installment payments on the debt, and that keeping the debt ceiling where it is will force the president, not only Obama, but future presidents, to run the government out of existing funds and allocate discretionary spending, and then also look at restructuring entitlements. So my question is, why should we raise the debt ceiling?
Yeah, to you, Bill Whiteland.
Well, I've been reading different accounts, and what I read is that the way it works for our listeners who don't understand, the federal government borrows money because we are operating a budget deficit. Come October the 17th, we will not have the statutory ability to borrow money, so the government now has to operate by living with what it has in terms of cash on hand, which is about $30 billion, I believe, and what comes in every day through revenue. From what I understand, this will get the government through about 1 week. And after that point, the demand for money outstrips the supply, which would then force Congress and the president to sit down and make choices no politician dare wants to make. Do you give money to an active-duty military person versus a disabled veteran? Do you give money to a Social Security retiree versus somebody on Medicare? So I'm not sure that the government could continue without borrowing, from my understanding of reading this.
Let me thank the caller and move on to more. Your calls will go next to Hugh. You're on, Hugh. How welcome.
Hi, thank you. John Boehner and the Fatigue Party have been ignoring and undermining democracy throughout the process. It's not opinion, it's facts. First, Obamacare was already voted on, as your guests have referred to, passed by Congress, signed into law, and upheld by the Supreme Court, all constitutional. And John Boehner is willfully ignoring these democratic acts. Second, Boehner's solution now is to pick and choose which parts of already passed laws House Republicans unilaterally want to budget and those they don't, ignoring the votes and imposing their will by blackmail. Voting is no longer their chosen method to govern. And finally, Boehner refuses to put the budget to a simple vote in Congress, a simple vote, doing that is what our Constitution states, and it might end it immediately. By refusing to use voting to find a solution, Boehner is undermining the very functioning of our democracy and the Constitution.
Well, Hugh makes Speaker Boehner culpable here largely for what we see unfolding. Bill Gwalin, response?
We need to have a more mature talk than calling it the Fatigue Party, number one. John Boehner has passed a budget. The House passed a budget that did not include implementation for Obamacare. The Senate produced a budget which included implementation money for Obamacare, and thus lies the gridlock. So that's not a valid point. But again, while we talk about the legality of Obamacare, I would just point out again that the way it was passed just has left a bad taste in the Republicans' mouth, and this is something they have to work out. Process, 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 until they finally get out of their system one way or another. So maybe we're seeing the final culmination of the act. Maybe this is Madam Butterfly committing suicide finally at last, but the Republicans have to exercise this demon.
Well, Fatigue Party may be not the appropriate word to use, but I was just looking yesterday at a study which I'm sure both Tom Mann and Bill Whalen, probably Julie Hirschfeld Davis, are familiar with. Keith Rule out of the University of Georgia and Howard Rosenthal out of NYU say that the present Republican Party is the most conservative in a century. And then a response to that, somebody from the American Enterprise Institute said, no, we've got extremism on both sides. So which is it?
Well, that's clear. I mean, the scholarly evidence on this, which is fully summarized in our book, demonstrates that we do not have symmetric polarization. Democrats have veered to the left on occasion in the past, but right now our politics is characterized by asymmetric polarization, both in terms of ideological positions, but more in a sort of a radical sense of disrespect for, as the caller suggested, the orderly processes of our constitutional democracy and a willingness to engage in this kind of blackmail, extortion, brinksmanship that are very extreme by any historical account in our politics. And Boehner may be a waif amid forces, but if he wants the job, he has to exercise its powers. And the caller is right. If he put a clean CR and a clean debt ceiling increase on the floor, they would very likely pass, and this so-called crisis would disappear, at which point, if Republicans are serious about their concerns on fiscal policy and deficits and debt, the president has a proposal on the table already. He's willing to negotiate, as he has been for months, indeed for years. Indeed, he's criticized by Democrats for his too eagerly being willing to compromise with Republicans.
I wonder if we get a reaction from you, Bill Whalen, but also I'd like to have a dovetail with an email I'm looking at from a listener named Paula, who says the GOP is fueling its own fire. Mr. Whalen, pent-up demand for Affordable Care Act is undeniable. A Affordable Care Act success equals a GOP nightmare.
Well, Tom's right. I mean, the easiest solution is to do the clean CR and to do the clean debt ceiling, but that's a think tank solution. I work in a think tank. Tom works in a think tank, and we tend to come up with these clean academic solutions. Politics is messier, and it doesn't work that cleanly, unfortunately. As to the caller's question, CNBC did a fascinating poll, I thought, last week, where it got two groups together of people and surveyed the two groups, and they asked one group how they felt about Obamacare. And they asked the second group how they felt about ACA, the Affordable Care Act. And what they found was in both cases, there was not pent-up demand. Actually, a plurality opposed Obamacare and a plurality opposed ACA. But two things stood out. When they asked Obamacare, more people supported it and more people opposed it. In other words, you put the president's name in there and it polarizes the issue. But then when they asked about ACA, the one thing that stood out there, 30% of the respondents said they couldn't answer because they didn't know enough about it. And this shows two tactical mistakes I think the Democrats have made here. Number one, the president should not have bought into the idea of calling it Obamacare. It's a pejorative. He should have pushed back. The original title of this bill was what? It was Protecting Patients and Affordable Care Act, I believe, or Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That sounds much better than Obamacare. And I think the second mistake the Democrats have made is they have not really argued, as Tom mentioned earlier, they've not argued the parts of the sum. They've allowed this to be a sum of the parts. So instead of arguing this over Obamacare, they should have been arguing over individual provisions, which are very popular, such as what? Such as pre-existing conditions, such as extending coverage to your kids in their 20s. Instead, we've let this be decided on one word, Obamacare, and that doesn't really do them much good, I think.
Let me go back, if I may, since we're talking politics now, and I want to get to more of your calls in a moment, but Julie Hirschfeld Davis of Bloomberg News has a piece that came out today about the race in Virginia between Republican candidate Ken Cuccinelli and Terry McAuliffe of the Democrats. And it's already, what's going on right now is really hurting the Republican much more than it is the Democrat. Isn't that right, Julie?
Well, the risks are definitely much higher on his side. I mean, everyone I talk to in both parties seem to think that that was the case. And you know, Virginia is an interesting state, obviously, because there's a lot of federal workers there, a lot of government contractors, a lot of Pentagon folks, a lot of people who work at the various federal agencies and commute into Washington, D.C. to work. So they're really feeling this. And a lot of those folks, or at least some proportion of them, wouldn't necessarily be engaged in a statewide election. And one of the folks I talked to for the piece, the former Congressman Tom Davis, who's a Republican, said that he thought this has the potential to really activate those people and get them angry about the current situation, and really the first chance that voters will have at all to take out their angst about this on any politician will be on November 5th when they go to the polls for that election and the New Jersey governor's election, but that's not really as competitive a race, anywhere near as competitive a race. This is still a very competitive race. Terry McAuliffe had the lead going into this shutdown, and it seems like Ken Cuccinelli appeared with Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, the Republican, who sort of has led this effort to make continuing government funding, conditioned on defunding the health care law. He's been sort of the leader of that movement, and the fact that Cuccinelli was willing to appear with him, even at a fundraiser, even not at a huge campaign stop, does kind of indicate, you know, the degree to which he's tied with that wing of the party. They've been very supportive of him. That's his reputation in the state, and so even voters who don't know a lot about either candidate, and there are a lot of them, if you look at the polls of the Virginia race, seem more likely to hold Cuccinelli at least more responsible than Terry McAuliffe for this. Now, both of them are trying very hard to distance themselves from it. Cuccinelli says he doesn't support a shutdown. He even came close when I asked him about it last week to saying that he would back a clean continuing resolution with no conditions, just get the government running. But he's had to really, really kind of strike a tricky balance, because in order to win as a Republican in Virginia statewide, you have to really get out the Republican base, which is very activated by this fight and very enthusiastic, at least a faction of them, about, you know, keeping up the fight, and also win a substantial number, about a quarter of independents there, who don't like this at all, and if you look at the polling numbers, are really turned off by the tactics that the Republican Party has used, even if they aren't necessarily with Democrats on the substance.
Again, Julie Hirschfeld Davis is a national political reporter with Bloomberg News. A couple listener comments via email. Yes, the shutdown is bad, but the aim is the raising of the debt ceiling. As we know, absolutely the debt ceiling will go up. The big deal about the shutdown is a subterfuge to increase the debt ceiling with facility while the American people are busy with the shutdown. And another listener says it's okay to raise the debt ceiling if you would spend that money on infrastructure and education and health care, but to give back in its majority to corporate America is wrong. We'll go to another of your calls. Patrick, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Earlier, you guys were discussing the fact that many Republicans believe they're winning this thing. And I just wanted to say that that's because they go home or talk to people in grotesquely gerrymandered districts that just represent people who are just like them. And the Fox News people would come and say, well, Democrats gerrymander too. But in a Democrat gerrymandered district, it would look like the United States. It wouldn't look completely white, completely old, and completely conservative.
This point that you're bringing up, Patrick, has been brought up a number of times. Bill Whalen, how do you respond to this notion of the gerrymandering creates a bubble for these Tea Party candidates particularly?
It does for the Tea Party candidates, but there are other Republicans who that doesn't apply to, in particular Republicans here in California. And this is something we haven't gotten into in a discussion, but it's worth pointing out. Think of Congress as having a rather limited supply of oxygen, and that oxygen gets used up in many ways. It gets wasted when you have bloviating over an issue like this. Something which is going missing right now is immigration reform. It was supposed to happen this year. The president wanted it. Republicans were talking about it. We thought this would be the year there'd be a deal. Maybe it somehow comes back to life after this, if there's some era of good feelings out of all this, or maybe it falls by the wayside. There are congressional Republicans here in California who are going back to their districts, and they are worried, and they want a deal. And if there were a reverse engineering deal by Boehner to get a clean resolution, they'd be the ones voting for it. Why? They're in districts that are heavily Hispanic. They see that as a growing population. They want to be seen as part of the solution, not part of the problem. And when something like immigration goes by the wayside, in part because of a problem like the partial shutdown, they worry. So it's not just Republicans in a bubble here. The Republicans not in bubbles who are very concerned about what's going on.
Well, Tom Mann, not only the stalling on immigration reform that we've seen, but there was certainly a lot of exasperation over Newtown in terms of gun control legislation. It would seem that Congress is at a kind of dysfunctional status now, isn't it?
Well, I really oppose the generic Congress as the focus of our unhappiness. You can't talk about Congress in general. You have to talk about the two parties, the split party control of the Congress. You have to talk about the strong sentiment among Republican activists, and most districts in both parties are safe. They are echo chambers. And that now in the Republican Party really, really leads to exaggeration of what they can do to cut government down to size and the rest. So it's not a congressional problem. It's not a matter of changing the rules or kicking all the incumbents out. If the Democrats won, just going back to sort of Bill's playing around with the verdict in 2012, Democrats actually attracted 1.4 million more votes for the House than Republicans did. But they gained 7 seats, but they're still 18 seats behind. If votes had been distributed more equally across the parties and Democrats had won the majority, we wouldn't be talking about shutdowns or debt ceiling fights. It really would be a different game because the kind of intense parliamentary style opposition politics that we've seen would be less effective, particularly in the House, which has been driving politics all year long.
Let me bring another caller in from Orlando, Florida. We're joined by Chance this morning. Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering how a default on the national debt would affect college students and their government financial aid.
Julie Hirschfeld-Davis?
Well, we had a story today on Bloomberg looking at really the catastrophic effect it could have if we actually get to a default. I mean, generically speaking, it would raise borrowing costs across the board. And we're talking about for governments, and we're talking about for individuals and homes. And, I mean, I think student loan debt is certainly, you know, chief among those things. So as the government, lost the ability to borrow to cover its obligations. As was mentioned earlier, it would have to start making sort of a series of very unappealing choices about which obligations to cover. And consequently, markets would react by, you know, the rates would go up for borrowing costs across the board. So it would make things way more expensive. In addition, we would be probably looking at, I mean, to put it in perspective, the $517 billion that Lehman Brothers owed when it filed for bankruptcy in 08, that's completely dwarfed by the amount of outstanding government debt, $12 trillion, which is 23 times as much. So, I mean, we would be looking at, you know, potentially a huge stock market crash and, you know, mayhem in the global economy, which would affect everyone. I mean, student loans would be the least of our worries. It would be, a pretty cataclysmic event.
Let me thank Chance for his call and read an email here from a listener named, actually on our website, a listener named Chris writes, I had no clue that the true Republicans' motivator is the fear that the Affordable Care Act will be really popular and effective. It will be impossible to repeal once it takes root, even if they win the 2016 presidential election. They're shutting down the government specifically to stop a program that will greatly help many people and even allow people freedom to leave their job because they hate government in principle. Government can help people by pooling them in the exchanges to reduce rates, but the Republican Party priority is to fight against government no matter what, even if it means preventing it from helping people. It's kind of a bizarre and shocking fact, but then if you think of the modern-day Republican Party, not so much. This is part of the rhetoric now, Bill Whalen, but, you know, you even said burn the village and all in terms of this Tea Party cadre. You know, the word anarchist, is in addition to the word terrorist, has been thrown around a lot, particularly in this partisan politic fight. But if we're talking about politicians who are against big government or against any kind of government, maybe we're talking about a kind of anarchy that they're at least representing.
No, it's not anarchy, but that's a little too harsh of a word, Michael. They're not trying to destroy the United States government. That is, there are certain laws that they have issues with. One thing which is missing in this conversation, by the way, I think, is we have not talked much about the relationship between the legislative and executive branches. Bill Clinton came into office in 1993, elected in a plurality, got 43% of the vote, and he put up a budget in 1993. How many Republicans voted for that budget? Zero. And I would argue that over the past 20 years, we've had a decline in the Congress's respect toward the executive branch. Clinton didn't get respect from Republicans. My God, they impeached him. Democrats did not respect Bush, and now you see Republicans disrespecting Obama. So part of this solution is obviously to find a better way for Congress to act, but we're also going to have to find a stronger executive, one who is just better in his dealings with Congress and making Washington work, but also an executive who can go out and fight for issues such as health care reform and gun control and things that are important to him.
And we go to Mike next. Mike, thank you for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for having the conversation. It just sickens me every time I hear the House and the Congress talk about the American people. Those guys are so far removed from what's happening. It seems like the only change that will happen in Congress and the system that keeps cycling every year is when we get some term limit vets. Is there any push toward that at all?
Tom, man, not much likelihood of term limits at this point, is there?
Oh, none at all, and a good thing, too. We've had more turnover in Congress in the last several elections than we've had in a generation. The problem is not longtime incumbent members. The problem is new waves of members have come in not caring at all for what came before them, not working within the system, not in any way trying to engage with people representing different interests and with different views to try to work out practical problems, but instead coming in with a fervor. We know what the right way is. Everyone else is either stupid or venal, and just let us have our way. I think term limits have proven by scholarly research quite unsuccessful in the states. Some have repealed them, and there's no chance in the Congress.
Let me thank the caller. And I had asked earlier if the shutdown or in what ways the shutdown may be affecting you. I just want to read a few listener comments on that score. One listener writes, I just started my own environmental consulting business converting waste to energy. I was going to a workshop offered by an NGO called SCORE Helping Small Business. Since they share an office suite with Small Business Administration, there's no workshop. Aren't the Republicans supporting the economic engine of the U.S. small business? And Joseph writes, I'm not personally being affected by the shutdown yet, but as is the case with most of these issues, it's not about me. It's about the lower rungs of society who are losing access to public services and government aid. Just because things still seem rosy in my sheltered white-collar world doesn't mean that the shutdown isn't doing real damage to our country and to our economy. And let me bring William on. William, you're on. Hi.
Yes, thank you very much. In all this negativity, I see a positive aspect, and I'd appreciate the guest's perspective on it.
Tell us, please.
Many people feel that for too long there has not been enough distinction between the parties as being progressive versus conservative. Some people would use reactionary, etc., but I'm just, let's say, progressive versus conservative. And I wonder whether the guest might feel that it would be good to have greater distinction between the parties, and perhaps the current discussion about the health care and about the debt ceiling will help to further define differences between and promote differences between the parties.
That's an interesting spin. Well, go ahead.
The caller makes a useful point, which is that everything wasn't so great when there was a lot of overlap between the parties, when the Democratic coalition had very conservative Dixiecrats, sort of racially conservative, and Republicans had both those supporting civil rights and those adamantly against it. We had problems back then, and some clarity in the choices is really a positive. But our political system is not a parliamentary system. It requires some agreement to talk across party lines.
Tom,
and right now,
seconds
it's
left.
Not happening.
Go to you, Bill Whalen, on this, please.
I think the best thing they could do would be to put together a commission. Have Paul Ryan on one side, Patty Murray, the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, on the other. Have public discussions about this. Have a Republican solution to cutting down the budget, the Democrat solution. Put it all on TV and let the public decide who's right.
Thank you, Bill Whalen. Thank you, Thomas Mann. Thank you, Julie Hirschfeld Davis. Richard Dawkins in the next hour up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.